We had a little problem with we had the phone system blink out for a second there, but we're okay now.
We're back connected. That's good. I think since we last talked, Marshall, a week ago, would you agree that, well, what's the phrase? It's been a week, right?
It's been a week on so many different levels, from Washington to the courts to international. Yeah, it's been one of those hectic weeks, and it
ended with quite a night, I guess. The overnight duty. Those of us on overnight duty this time, I'm afraid we were submitted to the spectacle of the minority leader in the House of Representatives talking for a good many hours, endlessly through the wee small hours. Did you catch any of it?
I caught some of it this morning, looking at the news coverage of it and some of the clips of it. And I guess
I don't think it was an event worth watching live. I mean, an awful lot of Mr. McCarthy, Kevin McCarthy's fellow members, took the night off. they left the chamber, even though he was stalwartly, in his own mind, of course, fending off the Biden Build Back Better legislation, the social welfare and climate change package, which the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, was hoping to move forward last night and perhaps even bring to fruition as an act, a finished and act for the president to sign by sometime next week. Well, that delay was a very effective bit of parliamentary theatrics, if you like, by the minority leader. But it wasn't exactly entertaining. I guess it's just another comment on the sort of low-level, argy-bargy nature of our representative politics these days in both chambers of the Capitol building. It's kind of depressing to see how it goes. On the other hand, there's some capacity for sharp observation and some neat phrasing. I noticed that at the end of it all, Representative Jamie Raskin from Maryland said that it was quite a feat of epic proportions for Mr. McCarthy to speak for all those hours straight and not produce a single memorable phrase, an original insight, or even a joke. And then Raskin uses an old gag, but it's kind of appropriate and seems quite sharp in this context. He said, McCarthy thinks he's a wit. But so far, he's proved that he's only half right.
Well, I tell you, it's 8 hours is a long time. But so now Joe Biden has passed both segments in the House of his major plans. This now goes on once it's signed, and approved by the House. And this now goes on to the Senate, where it obviously will have a few changes before it gets kicked back to the House.
Sure. But at the end of it all, I mean, there does seem to be. As you know, it's never wise to go into the prediction business if you're a journalist. But it looks like the whole apparatus is trundling slowly towards the president finally getting his way. Although many compromises will have been made on the way, and there's a lot of discontent about what's been lost out of these very ambitious pieces of legislation. We should never forget how incredibly how very transformational they could turn out to be. They're certainly the kind of governmental ambitions that for quite a long time I think the body politic in the United States wasn't really ready for. It's interesting that painful though the process has been, it seems that in a broad, if to use a broad brush, brush term, that the body politic is now comfortable with it, although, you know, the irritating spats about individual elements of the package have been there for all of us to see. The Economist magazine from Britain, which takes a very sort of magisterial overview of matters political and about policy in general, has an interesting essay this week. It talks about the era of big government. We know that's been argued about a lot in the United States in the last couple of decades or more, but the conclusion that the magazine draws is that the efforts by Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, remember, to limit government and constrain its size and constrain its influence over our lives, is turning out to be, in the long run, as you look at it more broadly, as the Economist always loves to do, look at things very broadly, that Reaganism and Thatcherism turn out to be just a blip on a general trend overall, and in other countries besides the United States and Britain, to for ever bigger government and ever bigger role played by government in our lives. And of course, the test will be in the Biden transformation, whether that turns out to be as effective socially and financially and culturally on the country, which is in this case found itself undergoing massive change. I mean, contributed to, of course, by massive pressures, not least of all the COVID pandemic that made very radical measures much more necessary, and I suspect much more palatable to the public than would have been the case before.
All right. Before we move on, do we want to run our little fanfare here?
I think we should hear the fanfare. Yeah, although it might seem a little out of tune with the tone of our material, but let's go with the fanfare and hear it for a particular piece of journalistic work this week.
All right.
It seems strange to be playing a fanfare for something as grim as this, but the fanfare is not for the event itself, of course, but for the journalism about the event. The event being the current trial from first-degree homicide and other charges of Kyle Rittenhouse in Wisconsin. It's a piece that provides, it's a journalistic piece that provides valuable background. It's a piece of, that particular brand of journalism, that particular kind of journalism that you know I appreciate a lot. It's well-illustrated journalism. I think I'm a television man, as you know, and have been for a long time. And to be able to blend the visual with the written is a skill which I think is vital, I think, to effective journalism. And in this case, it's a work by the New York Times, published well in advance of the trial. It's not a current piece I'm talking about. It was memorable when it came out, and it remains what I'd classify as required viewing, especially as we get to the stage where a jury has to make its deliberations about this case. The point about the video, because that's what essentially it is, although, you know, hefty journalistic investigation has been involved. A lot of well-judged graphics to illustrate that journalistic work, all led by a fellow called Mark Scheffler, who the Times has given the job title Executive Producer of Visual Investigations. Basically, his team, a very large team of Times reporters, examined in great detail all the video that they could get their hands on, official and just regular people's cell phone videos as well, of the events in Kenosha, Wisconsin, It's distilled. The work is distilled. The very real life context. That's something that's really always important for us when we try to understand an event. The context is filled in very fully. And a narrative that explains just how the confrontations developed that resulted in the two men being killed there and one injured in that rioting in Kenosha, where Kyle Rittenhouse was running around in his terms, offering help, medical help, but also carrying, as we know, a rifle. The whole story from the time that African American Jacob Blake was shot and paralyzed by a white police officer until 2 days later we get the shootings that the trial is now considering. It's a fine piece of explaining that things are just not simple, and the complexities of it are unraveled very finely in this video. I recommend you go to the New York Times website and take a look.
You know, these trials, I've been saying this for a couple of weeks now, and especially the Rittenhouse trial. I mean, these trials have the capability of shaking this country to its core heading into the holiday season if it goes one way or the other, really.
Absolutely. And, of course, they cue into and they cue up distinctly high-running fevers, passionate and angry position taking on both sides of the cultural and political divide, which is polarizing our country at the moment. But let me point out something that a few journalists are starting to chew on now as we get to the point where. Both trials. We're thinking of both the Rittenhouse trial in Wisconsin and the trial of those three men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery in Brunswick, Georgia. Now that the defense has rested its case in the Georgia trial of those three men charged with killing Mr. Arbery, it's worth pondering something curious that the defense has been using and which it has in common with the Rittenhouse defense. There's been a very odd turnaround in an argument that's been so much a feature of gun rights arguments, which of course is one of those hot button issues in this overall polarization I was just talking about. Gun rights proponents, who of course are highly engaged in both of these cases, these proponents have conventionally argued that a gun, you know the phrase, a gun in the hands of what they call a good guy is what prevents bad guys from killing people. In both of these trials, there's been a transformation of that argument. The danger to the guys who are claiming to be the good guy in both of these cases, according to their lawyers, comes from the gun itself. It's the gun that the supposedly good guy himself is carrying. Kyle Rittenhouse has said that he felt threatened because he was carrying a gun. It could be wrenched away from him and used against him. Travis McMichael in Georgia has been claiming pretty much the same thing. The victim, Mr. Arbery, could have taken his gun and used it against him. So, you know, it's an interesting turnaround. Dangerous things, these guns, which a citizen's right to bear is supposedly so precious.
It's once again, it goes along with everything else that we're going through. I have to go from what you're talking about, guns, to something that's absolutely ridiculous, which caught my eye this morning, and that is former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows blasted leader Kevin McCarthy for his leadership style.
Yep.
But then he went on to say that when the Republicans regain control of the House, they should appoint Donald Trump as Speaker of the House.
The jaw drops. Yes, it's rare, I suppose, that I'm rendered speechless, but this is one of those occasions. I think what what can you possibly say? I mean, quite often we talk about the divisions in the Democratic Party as being almost fatal, and somehow or other the Democratic Party holds together as a movement only by the skin of its teeth. But yes, the sight of a divided GOP in its so completely ragged and incomprehensible almost ways as I say, the mind is boggled, the jaw is dropped. I don't suppose. So can you imagine? Let's not go down this fantasy line. Yeah. But Meadows is clearly really rattled by this whole thing. So I'm happy to let him rant and go into these fantastical imaginings. I'd like to turn to something that again comes up from our talk last week, Marshall, in the international beat in this case. You remember how last week I was speculating without making any actual prediction. I mean, as I said, we were in dangerous territory if we ever do that. But I was speculating on how the Myanmar military's sentencing of the American journalist Danny Fenster to 11 years imprisonment and hard labor, it was going to lead to intense United States State Department pressure to have him released. Well, as you know, this week, thanks to a frequent intermediary in such matters of prisoners abroad, Bill Richardson, who is America's ambassador to the UN in Bill Clinton's day, was given custody of Fenster, and he was flown home to his family in Detroit. So the military junta in Myanmar clearly yielded to pressure, and I guess we can feel some relief at this development. But what I want to do today is just stress the point that it leaves, that this release, welcome though it is, leaves a lot more, a score or more, local journalists, Burmese journalists in Myanmar, otherwise known as Burma. They're left in detention. Since the coup back in February, about 100 have been arrested, 100 journalists, so media workers of all kinds. And then there were some releases over the summer, but those left inside still remain a complete outrage to world opinion. The imprisoned local journalists, they're people who are reporting for us, for international outlets like the BBC and the Voice of America. And some of them are facing really serious charges of sedition and association with terrorism. The pressure needs to be maintained to get justice for them. And this is part of a picture that we should never let go of, especially when we talk on Friday mornings about the whole business of journalism. The Reporters Without Borders organization was reporting that currently over 400 people in our profession are detained in different countries around the world. The year is approaching its end now, and they're also reporting that globally, in this one year, over 40 journalists have been killed while they've been pursuing their work. As I think you know personally, I've been thrown out of more countries than I've been detained in. I guess I'm lucky, but I'm aware that imprisonment and even death remains a perpetual risk for all my colleagues when they're reporting on a repressive regime. You know, I was just one of the reasons I wanted to speak about this today is that I've just been looking at some words written a long time ago by a good friend, also called David Holden, of London's Sunday Times. He and I worked together alongside each other in Idi Amin's Uganda, if you remember that horrible story. Uganda is one of those risky places where it's hard to conduct journalism. It always is in a dictatorship. Well, together, David and I fortunately escaped when Amin rounded up about 20 of our colleagues and had them pretty badly beaten up in the infamous Mackindy military prison there. We were lucky, but David later found himself writing about the journalistic danger in general, and he wrote, these are the words that caught me, "I have felt the boots going in, and I have heard the prison door close behind me, and I know how sickening the fear of such moments can be. Thank God, though, I have never suffered either bullets or the steel tearing into my flesh. Well, the historical fact is a couple of months after David wrote that, he was found shot dead in a street in Cairo, Egypt. And his murder has never been solved since then. Nobody knows who killed David Holden. So the dangers facing our colleagues remains fresh in my mind. Let's just not forget how much people are putting themselves at risk to bring us the news.
I want to go one other place, and we have so many different hotspots in the world. We have Taiwan, we have the gas Russia trying to supply to Europe, but also what's going on with all the refugees on the borders, and also Russia obviously moving its forces more into the Ukraine. That is a hot spot that really has the potential, with all the pressures that go on, to really explode.
Well, the task of governance and the task of keeping the populace in general of all countries informed about what's going on, you know, gets its emphasis there. I mean, I guess you'd probably say this every week that we might want to be talking about the world in general, but it's hard not to be an extreme pessimist. But almost every time we talk, we could say that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, but it's a tribute, I guess, to those people who are public spirited enough to engage in government and try and get a handle on the problems that would face us. And at the same time, you know, let's hear it for the journalists too, who try to keep pace and try to amplify the issues at stake for the benefit of the people who, at least in democracies, are supposed to have a say in what our leaders decide what to do in the face of such problems. but it's all a reminder, I guess, of the, you know, this is a serious business. I'm not going to complain about younger generations. That's a pastime of the old like us that needs to be abandoned. But it's easy to say that a lot of people just don't care about politics, don't care about how our own countries are run. It's a matter of indifference to them as they go around, go about their daily lives with what is argued are much more important matters like day-to-day living and inflation and all those sort of incidental things that are the nitty-gritty of everyday life. Well, these big issues do matter. One of the things that struck me about the prospects of the fantastical notion, for instance, of a Trump return in whatever role, is that, as a friend of mine was saying the other day, the American public has no idea how much their lives would change if the Trump era was in some form or other replicated again, because who knows what extra dimensions could be stretched to by a populist and mandate, freshly mandated populist force like this. I don't like sounding the knell of doom, but I think it's important to recognize that these are big and important issues, and it's a clarion call again, I think, to people to take seriously the work of people who are trying to explain it all for the benefit of ourselves as the voting public.
And a minor piece of good news I found, and that is President Biden's administration reaching out, President Biden himself with that conference call with China, and also are now setting up treaties once again in meetings every year with both Canada and Mexico, both things which are very important, and they're little bits of bright light in a pretty dark week.
Well, to quote a man who was known for his own belligerence at times, Winston Churchill, he said it was always better to jaw than war. of course, talking to people, even our opponents, our rivals, our competitors, is an important principle of enlightened leadership. And I, for one, am certainly glad to see what the Biden administration is doing in this direction.
David, it's always great to speak to you. We'll see what happens when we get together next week.
It will have been another week.
Take care, David.
Bye now.
David Taraschuk with the Media Beat. You can find him at themediabeat.us on the web.